meteor shower, you can talk about climate change. Our core curriculum matches more with climate than it does with astronomy, geology, and geography. And if you're okay talking about those three, then you have every reason to be connecting the dots between climate change. And as Heidi mentioned in that statement, make sure you're up on the latest research. It is part of your job. We should always be learning.
Chris Gloninger, we want to thank you for being with us. Was the chief meteorologist for the CBS affiliate in Des Moines, Iowa, KCCI-TV, resigned Friday after receiving a series of death threats and harassing messages as he covered the climate crisis. Now a senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group, speaking to us from Falmouth, Massachusetts. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
In 2020, Portland saw unprecedented protests for racial justice and widespread criticism of the Portland police and the institution of policing itself. It's now been almost 3 years since over 80% of Portland voters approved changing the city charter to create a new civilian-led police oversight system. The Police Accountability Commission has been hammering out the details, and their plan goes before City Council at the end of August. Totality of Circumstances will be hosting the commissioners live on KBOO on Tuesday, July 25th, and you can call in with questions or comments about the proposal. You can also send us questions at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com. Join us on July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m. and make your voice heard.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it.
KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 8 a.m. on Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, I believe, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned. Okay, that was weird. We'll just go straight to the program. Abe and Tracy, take it away.
Straight to the program, indeed. I'm afraid that my contract requires introductory music, so I'm just going to sit here quietly. No, I'm not going to do that. Good morning. Good morning, good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Abe Proctor, and joining me, as she does each and every week, Tracy Simmons, and we're going to talk today about a decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court about a week and a half or so now, and unless you have been deliberately oblivious, and for that I both congratulate you and express my envy, you will have heard of it. I'm talking, of course, about the court's decision to eliminate affirmative action in college admissions, at least the kind of affirmative action that is based on race and a history of racial discrimination in the United States. Tracy, this is this is one of those decisions where you can kind of feel the ground shifting under your feet, can't you?
Yeah, it's like the slipperiest of slippery slopes. Because, of course, we know that there's affirmative action in hiring, employment, in all other facets of civic life because of the, you know, history of exclusion of people in this society. And so you wonder, okay, so this is the first shoe to drop, you know, question mark? Of course, right, we're talking about highly selective private universities in this case, and some public universities that have used race-based admissions for years to level the playing field, to make sure that people from historically excluded, historically underserved backgrounds were able to be admitted. And of course, you know, there's always been legacy admissions, that is, the people who have children who, you know, graduated from Harvard and Yale, those people still are going to be getting in, right? And so the question becomes now, well, does this, you know, shift the demographics of those institutions that are highly selective and have used race-based admissions to try and balance things out a little bit? Or do these become fully white, fully Asian, you know, and maybe not even Asian, because it was Asian people that filed this lawsuit. So that's interesting as well. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But, you know, what happens? What happens now? And what is the next legal shoe to drop, right? Is it a conversation about the use of affirmative action data in hiring? Because as you know, for public institutions, there have been longstanding policies about making sure that we're taking into account racial demographics as we are hiring. So, you know, it's, to me, of course, a little bit scary, but, you know, I can't sit in fear, but we have to wonder what's next.
So what we hope to accomplish in today's program is to dig into some of the arguments put forth on both sides of the decision, and we also want to look back across time to contextualize this argument in the broader scope of systemic racism and racial discrimination in the United States. To sum up that particular line of inquiry, we'll just say at this point at the top of the show, yes, there's been a lot of it. A lot of systemic racism, a lot of racial discrimination in the history of the United States. So as you might have guessed, or you might be aware, the decision in the Supreme Court was 6-3, with the court's three liberal members in dissent against the overwhelming majority of conservative justices who now occupy the court. Here is what Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority in the majority opinion. The Harvard and University of North Carolina admissions programs cannot be reconciled with the guarantees of the Equal Protection Clause. Both programs lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race, unavoidably employ race in a negative manner, involve racial stereotyping, and lack meaningful endpoints. Thus bringing full circle the longstanding conservative argument that the real racism is not in fact the people who practice racial discrimination and who have benefited from centuries of systemic racism. No, the real racism is the people who happen to point it out, the real racist, that is, and the real racism is any step that's taken by either a governmental or a private entity, and that's very important to consider in this context. That's the real racism, any attempt to remedy the disparate outcomes of centuries of systemic racism and racial discrimination in the United States. Put differently, the court is acknowledging that yes, systemic racism is terrible. Racial discrimination is terrible. Unfortunately, they're not the sorts of terrible things that a government or a private entity can actually do anything about. That is the extent of the conservative argument in this decision. As you might imagine, the ideological differences that riddle this court have become even more exposed and glaring in the light of recent decisions. And we're going to get into some of those dissenting opinions later in the show and to give you some idea of what I'm talking about. I'll read a little bit now from Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissenting opinion. The court subverts the constitutional guarantee of equal protection by further entrenching racial inequality in education, the very foundation of our democratic government and pluralistic society, she said in her written dissent. I'm not a legal scholar, but I'm pretty good with words. And I can tell you that right there is an awful lot that Justice Sotomayor manages to encapsulate in that single sentence. I'll read it again. the court subverts the constitutional guarantee of equal protection by further entrenching racial inequality in education, the very foundation of our democratic government and pluralistic society. So there she's acknowledged that education lies at the heart of a pluralistic society and is the foundation of democratic government. Without it, people from underrepresented parts of society have little to no hope of ascending to positions where they're able to wield political, economic, and social power on behalf of other members of their underrepresented portion of society. Education is the great leveler in our society. And if we are not able anymore to look at the legacy of systemic racism when considering admission to an elite academic institution, then we are conceding that ground. We are stepping back from the mechanism of education as the great leveler in our society. And we are laying the groundwork for further disparity in racial attainment, further room for racial discrimination to work its pernicious magic in our society. And we are stepping literally backward in keeping with some of the recent decisions of the court towards a time when we did not take active agency in attempting to redress the iniquities of systemic racism in our country. And we're going to get more into that as the program goes on. It's hard to see any sort of upside to this decision, Tracy.
There is no upside. But, you know, we on this program a while back shared the policy platform for the Libertarian Party from 1984, and this was number like 3 on the docket, right, for them. So this has been a slow rolling, just like rolling back Roe v. Wade, a slow rolling attempt to bring us back to the 1950s, 1940s, pre-civil rights movement, where people were systemically excluded from opportunities, and in this case, an educational opportunity, which has a vast impact on the rest of one's life, right? Whether or not you can get a meaningful kind of career, whether or not you can be gainfully employed with a living wage job, right? All of these things are predicated on one's educational level and educational attainment. And we know that people who ascend from these, you know, very prestigious educational entities. I'm saying that with air quotes because I'm kind of tired of these folks anyway. right. And I feel like we need a revolution in our country about what is a meaningful educational opportunity, what is an equitable educational opportunity, and the fact that not everybody needs a 4-year degree. Let's just, you know, keep that a stack. But, you know, the idea that, you know, certain people who ascend from these very prestigious institutions end up on the courts that we are talking about right now, right? When we talk about the pedigree, also in air quotes, of people like Clarence Thomas, right, one of the members of the people who got rid of this, policy that I'm sure he benefited from some time back. He probably has forgotten. It's likely all of the trips and, fancy things he has enjoyed all that time because of his positionality as a Supreme Court justice. But we see that people who are able to ascend from these elite institutions are given basically a pass through life. And what we're seeing in this decision is that being now limited to the people who, quote unquote, are getting in based on merit, right? And merit in a not meritocracy that we live in is also a smokescreen for who's qualified, who's able, who's best, and that oftentimes is structured in the image of white supremacist policies, white supremacist ideology, dominant culture.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think to the list you just laid out, I would add, we need to have a conversation in this country about what exactly connotes prestige and why. It's prestigious to go to Harvard, right? It's prestigious to rub elbows with all the other wealthy and powerful people who go to Harvard. You know, that conveys a level of privilege and influence and prestige in our country. But apparently the court is dead set on making sure that sort of access, that sort of relationship building at that level of society is to be restricted largely to those people who afford to go there and who have the connections to go there. Because let's be very frank about what this decision means. This decision has eliminated affirmative action and selective entry criteria into elite college institutions on the basis of race. Do you know what kind of affirmative action it has left squarely in place, Tracy? Legacy admissions.
Yep.
Well, so certain sorts of advantages, certain sorts of affirmative action are alive and well and indeed thriving and ready to reassert themselves as the determinants of future success and the future potential to wield political, economic, and social power in the United States. This is nothing short, of yanking the ladder aside for people with ability who want to rise in whatever semblance of a meritocracy we're pretending to have in the United States, who want to rise to mingle in those elite circles and eventually to step into positions of political, economic, and social power. That avenue has effectively been taken away by this decision. So, as we've been discussing, very, very little upside to this decision. And you mentioned Clarence Thomas. I want to take a moment to dwell on Clarence because if you've been a follower of Clarence, and I use the word follower because fan, I think is, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to use that word. His opinions, whether concurring or dissenting, often involve a level of intellectual and moral gymnastics that stagger the mind, that really kind of take one's breath away. And this decision was no different. We've heard a lot, and we've talked a lot about this program, about the concept of judicial originalism amongst conservatives, meaning that the Constitution, almost 250 years old, should be interpreted either according to the letters written down on the parchment or according to what the framers 250 years ago thought and believed and understood the world to be. Again and again, we hear this talk about originalism. Oh, we can't go forth with this new progressive program because it defies the intentions of the framers and is thus unconstitutional. That, in a nutshell, is the doctrine of originalism. But here in this decision, Clarence Thomas has stretched this concept so thin that you can really see it for the sort of intellectual soap bubble that it actually is. Here's what I mean. Thomas looked back in time at a couple of things, the 14th Amendment in particular, which was one of the post-war amendments passed after the end of the Civil War, to do away with the legal and constitutional bases for racial discrimination, to remove at least, if not the societal and economic hurdles to a truly equitable society, at least the political and legal ones. And around this time, there was something else that was passed called the Freedmen's Bureau Act. It was passed before the Civil War and then renewed again after the Civil War. The Freedmen's Bureau was a government agency that was created specifically with the intent of helping to support those African Americans who had managed to escape the bonds of slavery by whatever means. The Freedmen's Bureau was there to protect their rights and to give them some sort of standing to make their way as free people in the United States. The Freedmen's Bureau was explicitly not a race-neutral entity. Its policies were not race-neutral. They explicitly considered the race of the Americans they were dealing with when deciding whether or not to extend the supports that the Bureau offered. Now, Clarence, looking back at the Freedmen's Bureau Act, decided that the choice of the word freedmen, rather than any explicit reference to the race of the people in question, without using words like enslaved or slaved or slave or slavery, anything like that, the choice of the authors of this act to use the word freedmen was evidence of the fact that they were in fact race neutral, and that the word freedmen is in fact a race neutral term, and that the Freedmen's Bureau did not exist in any specific or measurable way to help black people. And now this is astonishing. This is astonishing, because even if you have a passing familiarity with that period of history, you'll know that this is absolute bunk coming from Uncle Clarence. Absolute bunk. And many of the briefs that were submitted to the court as they were considering this case by historian and legal scholar, one after another, indicated that, yes, as a matter of fact, the 14th Amendment was not race neutral, that the Freedmen's Bureau was not race neutral and that there were all sorts of racially specific policies happening at this time with the deliberate and explicit intent of lifting black people out of the centuries of servitude in which they had existed. So for Clarence to look back through time and pretend that that wasn't so, that's not originalism. That's contortionism designed to project the modern conservative idea of colorblindness back across the centuries to retroactively fit the argument that they're making today in the 21st century. This has been a very long-winded way for me to say that this is a bunch of garbage, Tracy.
I mean, I don't think it's too long-winded because, I mean, I feel like we have to make these connections for folks. And of course, the colorblindness that is, you know, kind of espoused by the political right, the center right, not the far right. Of course, they are deeply espousing, you know, white supremacist policies, and we'll likely talk about that on a future show. But, you know, I think, you know, this kind of, this sense that colorblindness is the answer, that we are somehow going to, you know, through just, you know, our own, the beauty of our souls and the spirit of American, you know, freedom, somehow eliminate racial disparities without doing anything specific about it, is very much part of that dominant culture that exists within the center right, right? That somehow, you know, people are just going to forget about race and we're just going to somehow move past it, right? We had a black president, for goodness sake, right?
Yeah, everything's fine.
And of course, you know, we can continue to deny that racism exists, and Ibram X. Kendi has said it, you know, denial is the heartbeat of racism. It continues to exist when we deny that it exists. And yet, we have a, you know, Supreme Court who all have pedigrees from these highly selective, you know, Ivy League institutions telling us that it no longer exists, right? Racism doesn't exist. It doesn't. We don't need to consider anything about somebody's racial background. But yet Pell still exists, right? And Pell is about, you know, a person's financial burden and their financial status. So when I talk about a slippery slope, I'm like, well, what's the next shoe to drop? Because if you cannot use race in admissions criteria, what is to say that we can no longer use financial status? What is to say we can no longer use someone's ability status? And I'm thinking about beyond, you know, college admissions, but employment decisions, right? I'm thinking about decisions about, you know, who gets to do what in our society and how we have structured that. Most of the programs of social uplift are based on some kind of either racial or financial socioeconomic status. And if we say that for this particular segment, right, race-based admissions and highly selective institutions, how does that trickle down to all of these other areas where we are attempting to address past harms by leveling the playing field, right? And of course, when I talk about these particular people that, you know, have kind of leaned into this ideology of a colorblind society, they're often some of the most racist people you'll ever meet. They will tell you they are the least racist, right? I just will reference our former guy, and he said, well, I'm the least racist person ever, right? Okay. Don't you have cases on you about this? No, never mind. Right? So it's often those people who are so deeply steeped in denialism about their own racism, or who have benefited from racism in their lives, i.e. Clarence Thomas, if you are the only black person that is allowed in certain spaces, you get to then be the only black person, and you can be a gatekeeper for other black people, right? That is a benefit to a person such as Clarence Thomas, who does have quite a pedigree and access to all of these other things that he is trying to block other people from having access to. It's like opening the door, going to the door, and closing it for everyone else. And, you know, I talk about it for myself all the time that my you know, life's goal is not to open the door and walk through it and let it close, but to open the door, walk through it, and take the hinges off to make sure that other people like me, other people who have different backgrounds than me, other people who have different perspectives and ways of knowing and being in the world can come through that same door, right? And this is kind of the opposite. And so we don't know what this opens up for other legal challenges. And if this court gets to hear those legal challenges, they will go full throttle with this ideology around a colorblind society that we should not consider race. We should not do anything to try and address past harms. Because one, right, it's not really that big of a deal anyway. Because that's, I mean, that's really how I feel these people believe. Like, it's really not that big of a deal. But when we look at the demographics of these elite institutions, we know it's a big deal.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And I think we're starting to have an inkling of what sort of future legal and constitutional challenges might come to some of these other attempts to level a playing field. And we'll talk some more about that as we move on in the program. I want to read to our listeners some more sections of these dissenting opinions, because I think this is some remarkably astute stuff. And I think this will give those of us who believe deeply in righting the effects of historical wrongs and leveling that playing field and eliminating this dark legacy upon our body politic, gives us an important handle to get around those sort of questions. So Justice Sotomayor writes, in her dissent, "Today, this court stands in the way and rolls back decades of precedent and momentous progress. It holds that race can no longer be used in the limited way in college admissions to achieve such critical benefits. In so holding, the court cements a superficial rule of colorblindness as a constitutional principle in an endemically segregated society where race has always mattered and continues to matter." Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson weighs in also. "Even when the majority's ad hoc statistical analysis is taken at face value, it hardly supports what the majority wishes to intimate, that black students are being admitted based on UNC's myopic focus on, quote, race and race alone, unquote. As the district court observed, if these black students were largely defined in the admissions process by their race, one would expect to find that every such student demonstrating academic excellence would be admitted." So here she's saying, even if we believe the arguments that opponents of affirmative action are making, we can see by what's actually going on that these arguments are false. So this is one of these maddening situations, Tracy, that seems to occur with more and more frequency, that the majority on the court is simply crafting its decisions to match up with a set of ideological mileposts that it has established for itself that have been erected by the conservative movement writ large, and they don't really care about legal precedent, about constitutional precedent, or even the historical reality of life in the United States. It's whatever contortions they can undergo to project their ideological worldview upon whatever issue is before them. It's exactly the opposite of what the Supreme Court should be doing with its time.
I mean, I would argue that that's exactly why the Supreme Court is, you know, conceived as it is, and exactly the reason why some people revere the former guy for appointing the people he did. We now face, you know, the next 50 or so years of these people's decisions having an impact on our lives, and that was not on accident. That was, you know, completely intentional, and we know that this will have a major impact on, you know, the next, you know, 10 or so years of decisions that get made. Once again, right, this is not new. This is since the 80s. Folks have been, you know, eyeing the Supreme Court, setting up systems to make sure that it came to the fruition that it wanted it to, and here we are, right? We are in a post-Roe society. We are, you know, hurtling towards a post-affirmative action society, where people who have power can say, you know, these old policies really didn't help anybody anyway, and use claims of things like reverse racism, that racism somehow works in multiple ways, and that when you only consider race of people who have been historically excluded, you are by proxy excluding white people and harming white people. There is no data that shows that that's true. However, right, it's something that's been repeated enough, so it's been believed, right? And as far as, you know, people who benefit from these historical systems of exclusion, there's no impetus for those folks to stop that. And, right, that's why the government has come in over and over again to create some kind of channel, some kind of pathway for racial equity. But these folks will continue to undermine that as long as they have power. And so the question begins then, well, what do we do about this rogue, nasty Supreme Court? Right? Because we've had the conversation about expanding the court. We've had the conversation about just, you know, canceling it altogether and getting rid of that. We've had all of these conversations, but structurally, it won't happen as long as there are people in Congress who don't want it to happen, right? And so we're full circle. It's just really kind of the perfect storm of terribleness, of, you know, deeply entrenched supremacy culture that has been labeled colorblindness.
Yeah, that is spot on. And I'm really glad you observed that the current configuration of the court is, in fact, the result of a decades-long campaign to ensure that there is a conservative majority. You are right to trace the roots of this back to the 80s and even farther back. They even went so far as to grow little Brett Kavanaugh in a test tube so he could one day serve on the Supreme Court.
Man.
This is not an accident. You know, but neither is addressing it in that time frame sufficient. And after we take a call or two, I want to go back back in time to the period immediately after the Civil War so we can start looking at the historical foundations of all of this. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Santiago. Good morning.
Good morning. See, this is why I don't celebrate 4th of July. You know, ridiculous. Yeah, I'd rather celebrate Juneteenth than any of that business. But more importantly, to the point, you know, the real deal is that not only is this a decades long campaign of the conservatives trying to get Supreme Court justice into office, this is also a decades long campaign of squashing out real leftist voices in the political sphere. You know, if people forget that the reason why civil rights was even instituted was as a concession to the literal revolution that was on the doorstep through the Black Power movement and many other facets. Even King himself, after advocating for many years of nonviolence towards the end of his life, you know, assassination, he started to understand that what he had been doing is leading his, you know, trying to integrate his people into a burning house. Indigenous people have known this. You know, the fact that people like Clarence Thomas exist is that they've had an Uncle Tom every generation, just like they've had Tapatíos and, you know, Uncle Wangs and anybody who is of a non-white persuasion who will cape for the white establishment. You know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that people forgot that it was on the ground action, direct action, you know, sometimes in the face of, you know, sometimes violent action in the face of a system that wants to see people who aren't cis, white, hetero, Christian, male, they want to see them destroyed, period. I mean, they might adopt different flowery language because of the idea that, you know, they have to preserve the union. But since there's no real dissenting voices in the media on any meaningful level, they can say whatever they want and have no challengers. You know what I mean? So, I mean, the truth of the matter is that, you know, this is decades of voting for the lesser evil. This is decades of thinking that we voted out white supremacy and that we voted in civil rights and that we voted in women's rights and LGBTQ rights when there was literal blood in the streets mostly that of the victims of oppression. So, to act flabbergasted is really to just not really, like, understand the history here. I mean, Clarence Thomas is not unique in who he is. It might be unique to this century where we think that certain things are settled law. That's another thing, believing that abortion rights and civil rights and women's rights and LGBTQ rights are settled law. That's another thing, too. That's people saying, well, you know, we've got enough. We've done enough for you, haven't we? Aren't you being greedy? Don't you think that maybe we should stop somewhere and worry about what it means to reach across the aisle? I feel like you're being kind of anti-American here. You know what I mean? It's just, I mean, that the whole point is that this is that culmination. And now, you know, we're reliving the echoes of history here. So, I mean, if we're going to relive it in the sense that, you know, we're going to experience probably the hugest racial and sexual backlash that we have seen in like 50 years, then we have to understand they're coming for us. And, you know, we need to start educating ourselves and we need to start getting ready to defend ourselves, because these people are fanatical and they're not going to stop. I mean, it's they don't want me to exist. They don't want, you know, they don't want Chicanos to exist. They don't want blacks to exist. They don't want trans people to exist. They are so protective of their fantasy world that they are willing to kill anybody who makes them feel different about the fairy tale they've been told.
Hey, that was a fantastic call. I think we're going to leave it there. Really appreciate it. Wow, lots going on there, Tracy. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with Santiago. I mean, I feel like this is, of course, a long-term goal that has continued to come to fruition for the political right. We're seeing acts. And when I hear, you know, Santiago and others say, you know, we've been voting for the kind of least harmful person, We really, because we have a two-party system, have not had choices, right? Like, the other choice is the worst person, right? And so that just means all of this happens sooner. We're kind of in a catch, you know, 22, where I don't know what the answer is to get us out of this. Others will say, well, no, I know what the answer is. It's a violent revolt. And when I continue to hear that, I say, just the way things are structured right now, that doesn't look good for anybody. It looks really actually harmful for the people who are already struggling, who would be harmed first, right? And so, yeah, I'm in this weird space of like, oh my goodness, definitely not from a shock, but a what do we do? What happens now? Who is the person? Who are the people we should be turning to fix it? And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has decided we're not even going to have a primary. We're just going to slot Joe Biden back in there. And it's just, oh my goodness, it is really the stuff of nightmares for me.
Sorry. 503-231-8187. Do you mind if we hop in the time machine for a second, Tracy? I think there's something important we need to establish here. I want to take us back to the era of Reconstruction. Now, this is, when I say Reconstruction, I mean the roughly 10 to 15 years following the end of the Civil War. So roughly from about 1865 to the late 1870s. This was a period, of course, when the country was recovering from the great spasm of the Civil War. The Union troops were stationed throughout the states of the old Confederacy. The emancipated African-American population was taking its first tentative steps into a new country at that time. And I don't want to paint this as a rosy golden era, because it was fraught with problems. There was the Ku Klux Klan had its origin in late 1865 and went immediately to work terrorizing the newly freed African-American population, interfering with them as they tried to vote, harassing them in their places of business and worship, and on and on and on. There was violence towards the newly emancipated African-Americans from all segments of white society during this time. What kept things in balance, well, again, these are terms that aren't exactly accurate, but what exerted counter pressure on that was the willingness of the federal government to act in a non-racially neutral way. The passage of the three Civil War amendments, 13, 14, and 15, the passage of a series of pieces of legislation that came to be known as the Reconstruction Act, which took steps to ensure that the right of newly emancipated African Americans to vote would not be infringed upon, to guarantee them opportunities in education and in private life, the construction of what are now known as the historically black colleges and universities began during this period. So Reconstruction was this period of simultaneous hope and repression. But I want to paint you a picture of what exactly this meant and what it meant when Reconstruction came to an end. Over this period of time, of roughly 10 to 15 years, there were approximately 2,000 African Americans who were elected to public office at various levels. I'm talking everywhere from local governments to state houses to the halls of Congress. Roughly 2,000 people suddenly found themselves in a position to wield political and economic power. This trend showed nothing but a tendency to increase. More and more African Americans were being elected to office. Now, then came the election, the presidential election of 1876, in which the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes — now it's important to imagine or to remember right now that the Republicans at this time were the Liberal Party. They were the abolitionist party. They were the party that marshaled the political will to wage a war to finally topple the institution of slavery. They were the liberals at this time. So there was a disputed election. This is going to sound really familiar to people. There's a disputed election in 1876 in which there are allegations of fraud. There were incidents of white people turning out and using violence to prevent black folks from voting. It was an incredibly disputed election, which ended up actually with about 20 electoral votes being unaccounted for and it being indeterminate as to whom of the two candidates should receive those electoral votes. So there was something engineered behind closed doors. This was most definitely a back office, smoky, cigar-filled room sort of deal called the Compromise of 1877. And here's how that worked. The Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, was given the presidency in exchange for the removal of federal troops from the old Confederacy. And it was the presence of these troops that was able to guarantee any sort of foothold for newly emancipated African Americans in the fabric of American life. If not for the presence of these Union troops, none of the progress that I was discussing would have been able to take place. So this was the compromise that was reached. Federal troops were withdrawn from the Old South. The Republican Hayes was given the presidency, and the era of Reconstruction came to an end. And within a couple of electoral cycles, there were no more African Americans to be found at any level of elected office in the Old South. The Ku Klux Klan rose into its fullness, and the system, the regime of oppressive laws and customs that we came to know as Jim Crow, was put into place. So besides this brief period during Reconstruction, the history for African Americans in the United States started in 1619 with slavery, lasted 250 years, roughly until the Civil War. There was the brief period of Reconstruction, and then the imposition of Jim Crow after that for another 100 years, and then the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s, and then the transition to the era of mass incarceration in which we now live. So any sort of passing eye that one wants to take a look at this stretch of history with, it's hard to come away with any other conclusion than racial discrimination endures. It has always endured. And even at those points where the potential to do away with it had reached its maximum, always lurking in the weeds were forces willing to take it down again. So this current set of conditions in which we now live is the product of more than 250 years of institutionalized violence, discrimination, oppression, segregation, and incarceration. So for the Supreme Court to say that a colorblind society is what we must be in order to attain something approaching equity is laughable on its face. But if you scratch any deeper than that, it's not laughable at all. It is grim. It is dark. It is regressive. And this decision represents, as Santiago stated, a revocation of a hard-earned victory, a step backwards after decades of struggle. So for somebody like Clarence Thomas to engage in the mental gymnastics that he is engaged in, for somebody like John Roberts to pretend that this is the only enlightened way forward, it's absurd, Tracy.
It really is. But once again, right, going back to Ibram X. Kendi, denial is the heartbeat of racism. Denial that it exists is exactly how it will continue to exist and persist into the future. And right, we've got whole structures of society stopping us from learning the history you just kind of shared in a very brief way, right? We've got whole structures in society stopping us from talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've got whole structures in society creating laws that you can't say certain words, right? Burning books, basically banning books, burning books, stopping us from having knowledge in order for us to do something. And, you know, at some point, we've got to get really, really wise about this and build a political movement as a counter movement to this slow rolling of white supremacy it's the backlash. We are in the backlash. But the backlash won't stop until we stop it. And so who are we choosing as our political leaders to move us through this time? Right now, I don't see anyone stepping forward to say, I want to stop this from happening. We see the most tepid responses from the Democratic Party, very little, if any, from third party. So once again, right, we always talk about third parties. There's nobody really stepping forward to say, hey, this is not going to happen on my watch, right? And so who are the people we look to when there is a void, right? Like, at this point, we've got to figure it out.
Engineer Sonia writes to say, whether our liberation from institutional oppression will require force is up to those with the most power in those institutions. Sonia, that's a very insightful and provocative statement. I would have to agree. But it begs an important question, I think. Is it worthwhile then to work to ensure that the people with the most power in those institutions are those who are willing to liberate our system from institutional oppression without the use of force? In other words, is it worth continuing to work to elect the right people to the right positions? Again and again, Tracy, we keep coming back to this question.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I just, you know, literally the Republicans have Ron DeSantis, who, you know, is the backup candidate for the criminally indicted, multiple times indicted former guy who we know is, you know, in bed with the Proud Boys and other white supremacist groups. Ron DeSantis is their backup. He was just out, you know, campaigning, and of course, who showed up? People with Nazi flags and the like, right? So we are at a fever point, and we continue on the left to have nobody to choose from but, you know, Joe Biden, and you know, there's not even another name out there that I could point to. Joe Biden, who, you know, expressed himself as an aisle crosser and a person who, you know, had lunch with, you know, the most staunch racist of the last century, right? Like, make it make sense. At some point, we've got to get it together, folks. And, you know, I just see this short-term future as a really, really dark spot in American history, because Joe Biden is not going to be the person to stop this from happening.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Really interested to hear what people are thinking about relative to this conversation. Yeah, you're right, Tracy. This is this is a particularly frustrating moment because, as you mentioned, I don't think Joe Biden is anybody's conception of an avatar for for progress and for transformational change. I don't know. There's Robert Kennedy Jr.
Jeez,
that's a joke. I'm joking. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Tracy, earlier you were talking about future legal challenges to affirmative action programs, that even those that may or may not explicitly be about race. As it turns out, there is a guest editorial in the New York Times today by Sonia B. Starr, who is a law professor at the University of Chicago, and she's saying that there is just such a case making its way through the courts right now, challenging an admissions policy at an elite public high school. The policy is not explicitly race-based, but rather class-based and wealth-based. But it's being challenged on the ground that although it might not explicitly be about race, its outcome is very much about race, and that was its intended outcome all along. Therefore, it is unconstitutional. And it's hard to see. It's hard to see, based on the Constitution of the Supreme Court as it stands and the decision that it just handed down, it's hard to see that even attempts to level the playing field that are based on things like socioeconomic status, even these efforts seem doomed to be struck down by this court.
I'm trying to get y'all hip that these things don't happen in vacuums. They happen in clusters. And of course, this is a cluster of other sorts. Let me stop. But, right, like, this will be the next one. But Title VII exists as well. So Title VII is part of the Civil Rights Act, and Title VII said that you absolutely must consider race in employment decisions for public entities. Does not apply to private entities, like many of those did not, which is also problematic. But it is the reason why when you, apply for a government job, whether that is state, local, or otherwise a government job, you have to state, they oftentimes ask you up front, what is your racial background? It's not a quota system. They've moved away from that, but they are taking into account the racial demographics of the workforce. Potential challenges to Title VII could end up the same way this has ended up. And what that means is then employers, public employers, no longer have to take that into account. Now, I just want to name most educational entities that are public employers have, despite the growing number of students in diversity, right, like, you know, students of color are increasing, but most faculties are around 80% or so white faculty, depending on where you are. These programs have only minimally created opportunity for other people to exist in the workforce. So when you take that away, what do you expect will happen? And once again, right, these are systemic issues that we continue to deny exist by saying, well, we're a colorblind society. Anybody could be a teacher. You just have to, one, get a degree, right? So the education comes into that conversation. Who gets educated? Where do they get educated? Do they get a master's degree? Because it's really hard to teach anymore without a master's degree, right? So we're layering on all of these things in the professional space that you need in order to ascend to a positionality to be able to serve. And then we're going to say, oh, well, we're not going to consider your racial ethnic background either, knowing that especially in the educational space, representation matters. We know that students of color thrive in systems and spaces where they see themselves in that space. They thrive, and this is true for all workforce, right? So if you have a workforce that is predominantly people of color, but all of the managers are white people, right? There is a sense for those people of color who are employees that they will never, ever, you know, ascend to another level in that organization, right? It's called snow capping, right? We talk about it a lot in the work that I do. And it has an impact on the success of employees, the productivity of the organization, the output of the organization, the impact of the organization, right? And so we're seeing what I'm calling the first shoe to drop in this conversation. And if it, you know, continues to expand to now you can't take into account someone's socioeconomic status, you can't take into account someone's racial status in other spaces outside of college admissions. We are literally entrenching, you know, a dominant culture's insistence upon denialism of inequity and creating permanent underclasses of people who are poor and people of color. And that already exists, so we're just exacerbating that reality.
503-231-8187. Let's go to Barth. Good morning, Barth.
Good morning. A couple of things. I think this is a very interesting conversation and one that's not getting enough attention. So thank you, you two, and thank KBOO in general. But Abe said that during the Rutherford Hayes election that the trade-off was that troops would be pulled in order for him to get the presidency. And that's certainly something you don't hear too much about in school. But one of the other asides you said is that the Klan rose to their supremacy or grandest expansion after that happened. And I just want to take a little issue with that and say that yes, that was a big boost to the Klan, and the Klan became a stronger and more resonant organization. But
It had better days, bigger days ahead of it. You're right.
Yes, I mean, here in Oregon, you know, in the 20s and 30s, the Klan elected governors, the Klan elected mayors and representatives. This was a big Klan state, and the Historical Society has put out some interesting stuff in their magazine about the predominance of the Klan's activities and success here in Oregon. And that's a sad chapter that people ought to know a little more about. That's my two cents. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks, Martha. Appreciate it. Lest we think we live in a progressive utopia, I think Cassie and I, towards the history of institutionalized racism in our own state, is never a bad idea. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Francis. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to mention Reverend William Barber's Moral Declaration for America, which he released on July 3rd. And he spoke of all this stuff. And I'm going to quote him right here. When a Supreme Court and political leaders conspire to lie about history and embrace actions contrary to love and justice, their actions are both piracy and perjury at the same time. They have conspired to assassinate the hopes and possibilities of a fully representative democracy to make way for the unimpeded rise and sustainment of the evils of domination, authoritarianism, racism, economic oppression, militarism, and empire tendencies, all of which are contrary to our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. Nay, just called for people to take. He said, "This is a very crucial moment in our history, and people need to take whatever action they can to do something about it." So, anyway, I have admired that man for a long time, and I wish he'd run for president, but you know, he's probably too radical because he believes in poor people. But I appreciate you guys.
Hey, Fran-
I just wanted to mention that.
Well, thank you, Francis. Appreciate you sharing that with us. And that seems, I think, a good place to end, Tracy. We're just about out of time. Share your final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's for us not to be complacent. And, you know, as Bart said, this is not a conversation we're having. I'm just not quite sure what's going on with the American people writ large, but we are spending a lot of time focused on celebrities and reality TV and just nonsense, a whole bunch of nonsense. At some point, we're going to have to get real about what matters in this country. And if it's not each other, I don't know what it will be. But we're really going to have some kind of awakening. And I don't know what it is. I thought it would be Dobbs. I thought it would be, you know, the former guy and his corruption. I thought it would be all of these things. And it just seems that we're very distracted. We're distracted by a lot of things that are not going to play into the future of the country. While all of these things are happening right in front of us, we cannot be complacent. We need to wake up. We need to get active. And we need to start thinking about how we're going to care for ourselves and each other as the environment continues to change, as the socio-political environment continues to further and advance white supremacy, as entrenched in our culture. It's time to wake up. Let's get active, people.
Absolutely. And I think we'll leave it there. Let's get active. And we look forward to sharing with you on this program in the weeks and months to come, ways in which you can do just that. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. Thanks to those of you who picked up the phone and joined the conversation. We appreciate you. And thank you to all of you who support this radio station. Remember, you don't have to wait for a pledge drive to help keep us on the air. You can visit kboo.fm, click on the donate button. It's fast, it's easy. And
you are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. And streaming on the web at KBOO.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at KBOO.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio.